They moved west of Nevada someplace where there was water. At that time, not a lot of people. They had to do something. You know, that's what I remember most about the Depression, that and the fact that we made pretty fair money at that time. The act was really in great demand through that time. And banks had failed. What do you do with money when you're traveling around the country in a railroad car or a truck or, you know, whatever this is? So my family used to convert the cash money into diamonds and other jewelry that they could wear. Something that they didn't have to even hide it someplace, right? You had your hands on it. The diamond rings, you had them in your hands all the time, something. So you could, and then, of course, cash those in when as needed, right? But cash money was really rare. I can remember playing some dates in the Midwest, far west, and people coming, looking to me like rural agricultural sorts, coming up to pay for their tickets with the old dollar bill left from the 1800s. They were about that long, about that wide. They looked a lot like our current ones, but this huge shin plasters was the slang name for them. And $1 bills and things like that they had obviously saved for 30, 40 years. It'd been someplace or another, maybe circulated in the community, I don't know, you know, but hadn't had wide circulation to trade for the newer ones. And old coins, maybe. My mom put together quite a collection of old coins that would come in that were, you know, across the counter change at the time. Yeah, it was a funny time.
Well, what did you notice that changed once World War II started? How that changed the country?
Oh, well, it motorized things. The war, the Second World War, absolutely dominated our entire culture. Everything came from, went to, was altered or directed by that. I know it isn't really the most popular view of that period, but the Second World War is really what got us out of the Depression. And it got us out of the Depression by the government spending so much money on the war. It was government money that built the airplanes, that put the money in the pockets of the workers at Lockheed, at Amphenol down the road, things, right? Mm-hmm. I know that's not a popular Tea Party view of the world right now, but that did fix it. I'm not advocating another war, but it was government money that brought that back up. And then once the soldiers started to return, they wanted jobs, and there weren't jobs. Many of them invented jobs, things that had not really existed before 1946-7 began to exist and grow as industries and things. Many of the returning servicemen went to school. The professions grew in numbers of people involved in law and medicine, education. Those things were all big changes. The war itself caused some other changes. Things were developed in relation to the military that might not have been developed, or at least might not have been developed as much by that time. I was thinking specifically of some of the aircraft things, helicopters, for instance. I remember playing a date someplace, I think it was in Indianapolis, but I'm not sure of that. With the Amelia Earhart, the aviatrix, the woman flyer of the 30s, as she flew in an autogyro. An autogyro was a precursor of the helicopter. It worked with a propeller in front, like a World War I airplane, but instead of a rigid wing, it had a spinning blade on top that functioned as the wings, but it took the power of the forward thrust to turn the windmill on top. But it, too, rose and came down almost vertically. Not quite, almost vertically. And it was a big deal. She landed in the infield. I was a kid sitting on the, probably one of the trunks, one of the boxes, watching this come down. Wow. anyway, the Second World War then developed that helicopter craft rapidly, and it might not have for a long time. I don't understand. Anyway, I don't know what she was signaling. I was thinking about telling you another story. I'll tell you another story. In 1948, I was doing some radio work in San Antonio, Texas, and a man, I was in the studio and I was coming out of the studio, and a man grabbed me and he said, "Our announcer hasn't shown up. Can you announce this next show?" And I stumbled around and said, I don't know. He said, "We'll pay you double scale." I said, "Sure." Twice the minimum wage was all right for me. And they handed me a script, and we went right back in the studio and began to broadcast. And it was a political campaign show for Lyndon Johnson. He was running for the Senate. He was a congressman running for the Senate in Texas in 1948. And I did my announcement, whatever I was. I introduced somebody, and then that was it. And then said goodbye at the end. Then the man, the same man, called me as we were leaving, and said, asked me if I would be willing to do more announcing for the campaign. And I said, "No, but you did." He said, "The same kind of way." I said, "Sure." And I did. We did a lot of radio. Of course, there was no television in those days. Did a lot of radio. But we used to drive into a town, only out of size. All of the Texas towns, that era anyway, all had sort of city squares. There'd be a county courthouse, a city hall, what have you, and a almost Mexican-Spanish style plaza in between them, a park. Usually set up in one of those. Either there would be a ready-made dais of some sort there, or we'd have a flatbed truck and put chairs up on top of that, or whatever it was, and set up the public address system. My job was to get up and start the thing and call everybody's attention, and the people would stand around out on Main Street looking up over the sidewalk at the thing set up in the park, sort of affair, with City Hall in the background, whatever. And I did do that. And then I would introduce whoever the lowest office Democrat in the area was. And then he in turn would go up the ladder of hierarchy till they got to former President Johnson. One of the things that, why I thought of it, the way Mr. Johnson used to come into towns like Sydney or what have you, smaller than Oneonta, he'd land in the open field nearby by helicopter. Helicopters are brand new in that time, right? Mm-hmm. Hardly anyone had ever seen one. And they made funny noise. I mean, sound they made. And the whole town would come rushing out and look around to see this thing coming in. So he'd gather the crowd, and he'd come out of the helicopter, and he'd take off his Stetson, and he'd throw it out over the crowd. And in addition to announcing, my other job was to go out and find his hat. Because it would take about as long for me to find his hat and get it back as it would take for him to get out of the plane and down the people and whatever. And then we'd get up on the platform, and I'd start the announcement. Yeah. But it was a fun period.
So did you get to meet him?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, neat.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, I've at least got photographs of me and Senator Schumer at the same parade. But not anything, I don't think, of Mr. Johnson. The one thing I will say about him that a lot of people forget, 1948, one of the planks in his platform was civil rights. And he never wavered from that all those years. And the civil rights issue in 1948 South Texas was different from what it was in a lot of other places. And in fact, it was different from what it was a lot of other places. It was a problem. Part of the problem was that at that time, the Hispanic population was treated almost as badly as the African-American population. And I think it's better now, but it's still not really terrific, you know? As in the problem in Arizona. Of course, that's immigration, but it's also splashes over into the resident population as well as the indigents, you know. Funny business. In the 1930s, the German-American Bund time, rise of the Nazi Party in Germany, as a boy playing, being in New York City, and blonde, blue-eyed, Germanic-looking kid that I was, and was. inevitably, someone on the street would press a paper pamphlet into my hand, almost always anti-Semitic. And not too long ago, I was in New York, a couple of years ago, I was in New York City at some meeting or another, and I was walking down, I think, 50s, someplace, I don't remember where, someplace in there. A fellow stepped forward and handed me a piece of paper, and I looked at it, and it was for a porno enterprise of some kind. And I thought, look at that. It used to be anti-Semitic, now it's, there's no limit to the way you can make pornography, right? Obscenity can occur in all kinds of ways. Something, the targets change, right? But the ideas seem to linger on. Anyway, I don't know what else to tell you about. How about teaching?
Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit about how you decided to go to college and what your parents felt about that.
Well, my parents were all in favor of that. And I was lukewarm. But I couldn't figure out any other way to continue playing ball. And I thought, you know, I can play ball and chase girls, and other than that, do pretty much like I've been doing now. Okay, I'll do that. And so I went to school.
Where'd you go?
A couple different places, but that's, I probably ought to back up a little in that. I had great good fortune. I had learned to read before I ever started into school. My family wasn't very familiar with child-raising culture, and so they taught me how to read when I was just a little kid. And having the ability to read when you entered kindergarten, first grade, always put me ahead of everybody. And I always managed to stay that way. And in traveling from school to school, as I had to do, one of the things that would happen was that, I don't know, I'm going to invent places that are probably inaccurate, so forgive me, but Louisiana would believe that their school system was ahead of the school system in Georgia. I don't, maybe it's the other way around, maybe neither of those states were involved, I don't remember. But that sort of thing. And so if I would be in Georgia, which was the inferior state, if that's what I just said, and go to a school then in Louisiana the following week, they would want to put me back a grade. And my dad would argue, no, Freddy can do this, you can do that, third grade, fourth grade. He said, we don't know about it. Oh, test him. So they'd test me and I'd pass. Yes, so I'd stay at that grade. If it went the other way and they wanted to put me ahead, he'd say, okay, And so they put me ahead of grade. So I started college when I was 15.
Oh, wow.
Right. That's the upshot of all that story. Which was fine. I don't want to sound arrogant about it. I was always a competent student, if not enthused. Some things would enthuse me, but not everything. And I don't know. And then I got my master's degree and decided, I was in Washington, D.C., and got a job teaching at George Washington University, and like that. And I thought, college teaching is a pretty good racket, I like this. So I decided I would get my doctorate. And so I went back to school for that and had a job as a, a young instructor of something at Columbia. And Mrs. Miller was a student working on her master's degree there. And we were together. I was in charge of building scenery for the theater. She was required to take a class in theater, and that involved working in the laboratory scene shop. And she was such a good carpenter that I got to know her well. And one night, I remember this one very well, we built the scenery at nights because everybody worked during the day and went to school during the day and whatever, so we worked at night to build scenery. And would stop for coffee after we did it. She and I lived in the same apartment building in Amsterdam Avenue. One day I said, Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet playing downtown tomorrow. Wouldn't you like to go? And she said, yeah. So I said, all right, we'll meet here. And we got to the theater, and I walked up to the box office and said, two. And she said, oh, it's a date. So that's the way we got started dating. It was kind of informal, casual. And it's been a tremendous partnership ever since. Yeah. Very, like I said, two good decisions in my life. That was the second one. A lot of the others haven't always been the right decision, but those worked out well. But I started teaching then, really, started in 1948 and retired in 1998, so it made a nice, neat number. I like neatness. And she taught at Hatsuko here in Oneonta also for, 30 years. I'm not sure how many years she was there. Among other things, for a couple of years she was there and taught classes and then didn't, I think, and then it was absolutely steady for a number of years, and then I'm not sure. But long time. And she continued to teach for several years after I retired. I don't remember, 3, 4 years, 5. Students always liked her better than they liked me. And that's because she's short. That's the only reason.
She mentioned that to me earlier. So when did you move to Oneonta, and what got you here?
Well, we came in 1964. I had been teaching at Boston University, and our youngest child, was born in the winter of 63. And I had had some correspondence with a man here in Oneonta, Lawrence Goodrich, who was then chairman of the English Speech, Theater, and Foreign Language Departments, all right, which was almost a division instead of just a college department. I'd had some correspondence with him, and I got a letter while over in Boston suggesting that there was growth going on in the Sunni system and this, that, and the other, and they were looking for experienced play directors and stuff like that there. And I answered the letter. And it kind of started a correspondence. A little later, I got another letter from him explaining that he was going on sabbatic leave and this, that, and the other. And I thought, you know, it really makes it sound like a nice place over there. And Boston's a swell city, but it was a pain in the neck commuting in and out of the city, and I don't like cities much anyway. Mm. And I thought, well, we'll have a look at it. We'll see what it's like. So on a nice spring day, I think it was Easter recess, on a nice spring day, I drove over the Mass Turnpike, down Route 7, there was no I-88, down Route 7, and I got into the Schoharie area and that beautiful hill down toward Cobles Hill, and I thought, God, I like this. If the job looks decent at all, I'm willing to move to live in this country. Well, I've never regretted it, but that Lawrence Goodrich was a sneaky guy. The SUCO campus was not built then. Everything was in Old Main. After we'd done some other things around, he said, let me show you where we're going to have the new campus. Drove up to approximately where the Hunt Union building is now. The pond was the reservoir. It was a little climax forest all around it at that time. And a dirt road running through that, it would connect with what is now the street there. And got out of his car, and the two of us are sitting on the front of his car looking out at the hills, beautiful day, and he starts discussing salary. And I thought, you know, that's not fair. You're taking advantage of a poor boy. But advantage or not, I took it, and we moved here. Late summer, I was directing barn theater, a straw hat type, in Massachusetts that summer. So I finished that job, and then we moved here. And I've been very happy here ever since. We lived first in Colliers Hill, then a swell house up Franklin Mountain, old 1830s New York farmhouse that we got to renovate and rehabilitate and do all kinds of stuff to. Had a swell time there. And then, I don't remember, about 18 years ago or something like that, we moved from that to a relatively new 1950s-ish ranch house out the Ostawa Road in Otego area, well out in the woods, even more isolated than the Franklin Mountain house had been. And we were there for quite a while. And really enjoyed that. And then when they began to build this complex of houses and apartments and what have you, we decided that we were getting older and it might be wise to move to where there was public transportation and other people, and our nearest neighbors could even be seen from our house. So we moved here, and it's been very nice.
How many kids do you have?
Just two children.
Two children?
Yeah. And and they're swell. Our son is now going to taking classes at SUCO again, working on an advanced degree in geology. Our daughter has, I'm not sure what her degree is. I know she's gone back to college in order to get an advanced degree in library science, but whether it's a master's or master's of education, I don't know what the degree is, right? And is a librarian in the school in the St. Albans area of Vermont. I don't remember the name of the town, the school district. I should. Maybe it's Colchester. I don't know. St. Albans is the metropolitan area, a little smaller than Sydney. And the other villages are Vermont villages, right? And their home is near one of those. Their house is an old Vermont farmhouse, and I measured it one time. It's almost exact by rote. It's almost exactly 12 miles from the Canadian border. So it's pretty far north. At